Hi, welcome to Pathways. This is the podcast where we speak with Grenadians and other West Indians pursuing careers in the STEAM fields. Today's discussion is going to be another interesting one, so stick around. We hope you find something that resonates and helps keep you going along your journey.
Carolyn, Ariel, and Frank, hello. Welcome to Pathway.
Thank you so much for having me, and good day to yourself as well.
So, Carolyn, can you get us started by telling us a little bit about what you do and where you are currently?
Okay, sure. So, like the host just said, my name is Carolyn Ariel Ann Frank. I just finished a master's in architecture. I am currently in the Kingdom of Morocco. I'm contemplating doing a PhD. In fact, I've been approached to do it by the school. And right now, I am working as an architect and as a lecturer.
Great. So you're lecturing at the same school that you attended?
No, I'm lecturing at a private school.
Okay, interesting. All right, so tell us a little bit about yourself as a young student growing up. What were you like in your primary, secondary school years?
Okay, so let's see. Primary school, I was a pretty wimpy kid. I was super sick with asthma all the time. Didn't make lots of friends because I was very shy, you know, being the first kid, everyone dotted over me at home. So I wasn't understanding why at school everyone wasn't just automatically giving me attention. So that was something that was a bit hard for me to get into. However, my grades have always been stellar. So that's one problem. That's one area in which I've never had a problem. I was a reader from a young age. I vividly remember reading by the age of 5 already. I remember being in kindergarten and being super proud because I already knew how to write my name and how to read some stuff while the other kids were just learning that. So going on ahead in primary school, of course, you know, I was always an overachiever, and I think, you know, Caribbean parents, they can push this onto you, but for me, I liked it. I liked always being number one. I liked always getting good grades. Like I said before, I was dotted over on at home. So being always number one, that was like my way of getting the attention I wanted from the teachers and everyone else around me. So yeah, it kind of worked out. It totally worked out. And that continued all the way into secondary school. But of course, you know, by secondary school, I had navigated the ways of socializing with people. So by that time, I actually became a pretty friendly and pretty outgoing person. I was super involved in secondary school. I was in, you know, Rangers. Secondary school was such a long time ago. I don't remember what I did. But, you know, like, I would take part in the choir. I was on the swim team. Yeah, I was just doing lots of stuff. Oh, yeah, I remember I was also on the SU Knowledge Bowl team as well. No, I was just pretty much out there. I had finally found my niche, and I was finally able to manage being social and getting good grades. Now, going off into TAMCC, I think I need to backtrack a little bit, because ever since I entered the grade of, I think it was the fourth form, I always knew that I wanted to do architecture. And this love for the domain fell upon me when I started doing technical drawing. Now, you may say, technical drawing, that has nothing to do with architecture. Well, yeah, but no. For me, what gave me the inspiration is when I started putting those first lines on the paper, and I noticed, well, hey, look at this. I am creating something. And if I am to follow in this field, I would be able to create things that would last forever. So it gave me this, I don't know, I call it sometimes the God complex. You know, I'm not trying to be egoistic or anything, but that's just the way I saw it. I was like, wow, I can make something that everyone can see and everyone can use. So at that moment, I was like, you know what? I'm going to be an architect. And I've been working on it. I started working on it ever since then. That's why I went to college and I did building construction technology, because I knew I wanted after that to go into the field of architecture. So how did I go from studying in the Caribbean to coming all the way over here to North Africa, leave an English-speaking country, come to a French-speaking country?
Right.
Entirely different story.
Yep. So you're going in the exact direction that I'd like to hear. What was the process for you starting out? So Form 3, Form 4, you started doing technical drawing, which I could ask the question, because for me as well, I took a similar path and, you know, I did technical drawing and I was like, oh, architecture is great. And then you get into architecture school and it's not the same thing at all. So it's a good stepping stone, but it's definitely, you know, a different direction, a more artistic direction maybe. So what was that process for you, like moving from building construction technology in TAMCC and then going on to pursue a degree in architecture and then a career after the fact?
I think it started with exactly what you said. After a while, you start noticing that what you're doing, be it with technical drawing or with building construction technology, it's not very artistic. And all the plans, yes, you may arrange them differently, but after a while, they all pretty much look the same. It's a box or a rectangle with openings on a roof. And you want to do more. I remember having this frustration that I wanted to do more. But at that stage, no one is giving you the tools to do anything further. So you're stuck trying to make your square as different from everyone else's square as possible. And I remember, I think I started looking at video games and paying attention to the things that you would see in movies. And I was like, you know what? How do I get my buildings to look like this? So well thought out, with every piece in perfect harmony, but different, yet functional, beautiful to look at, yet, you know, it's structurally sound. Then I started looking up what exactly it means to be an architect, you know? So I started reading up. I wasn't much of an internet savvy person back then, you know? That was like Caribbean 2011, come on. So I wasn't much of an internet savvy person. So I would go to books. I would go to the libraries, or I would have my dad. He had a National Geographic subscription. So I asked him to get me one for Architecture Digest as well. And I would look at that and I started to become inspired by some of the stories that some of the architects had posted. The way they felt, the same feeling I felt when I was first introduced to technical drawing. So some of them, it was like other fields that they call it. I think it was basically technical drawing, but you know, in different countries, they give it a different name, but it was basically the same thing. Then they were feeling disappointed that they wanted to create something different, but they didn't have the tools to do it. And I was like, oh my God, this is me. I love this, but I don't like the way it's being done. I want to do something differently. So when I finally understood what architecture really was, I was like, you know what? That's exactly what I want, right? Not building construction, not technical drawing. I don't want to be a draftsman. I want to be a proper architect. Now, I'm pretty sure like I mentioned earlier, my parents have always been on our shoulders to not just perform well, but to be the best performer. Do the best that you can. Always try to be better than you were the semester or the term before. I must, however, point out, they never pushed us into competition with other people, just to compete with yourself. And another thing they always told us from a very young age is, if you want to go into university, and we want that for you, we absolutely want you to go to university, but we can't afford it. So I think at this point, I need to pause, give you a little backstory. Let's just get into the backstory. I have been on scholarships ever since I was 14 or 13 or 11.
Since secondary school days, okay?
Yes, secondary school days. I've been on scholarship ever since. So for CXC, that was covered by an institution. When I decided to do a year of business school, that was also covered. And even when I was in TAMCC, that was covered. Now, the great thing about being in this scholarship, I was with this this program. It's the J.J. Robinson Foundation. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
I haven't.
It's an amazing group of persons, right? And what I liked about them is that they provided you not only with a scholarship, but also with a mentor. So my mentor, he goes by the name of Peter Godfrey. And he's also an architect, by the way. He's an English architect, but he is right now based in Grenada. So he has been really the best guide ever. He has helped me so much in doing all the things that I need to do. He has really been there to guide me. And when I told him, I was like, listen, I really want to go study architecture, but I need a scholarship. And I had no idea how to go about this. I was like, what do I do? And he was like, okay, you know what? There's a scholarship that's at the Ministry of Education. You go there, because I had no idea what this was. Mm-hmm. You go there, find out which scholarships are available. I was like, you know what? This sounds like a great idea. So I went there. I think at this phase, I must have been in the last year of college when I decided, you know, that I want to go further, but I didn't know how. I knew that I couldn't, not I couldn't, but I didn't want to take a loan because I don't want debt. I didn't want to study in the Caribbean either. I wanted to study really outside of the box. So I went there and I said, listen, guys, I want to study architecture. What do you have to offer? And of course, they looked, they were like, okay, well, we have a priority list. If your field is on the priority list, then we're going to have scholarships open for that. And they gave me the whole, you know, the rundown. Now, I had scholarships for Japan. I applied for Japan, Morocco, Serbia, Italy. I got accepted for all of them. However, the Moroccan scholarship was the most attractive. Remember I said, guys, I've been on scholarships the entire time. Let's cut to the chase. That means that my parents would not be able to financially support me if I go to university where I have to pay. So I needed a scholarship that covered housing, tuition, medical expenses, books, and gave me a stipend. So it couldn't just give me housing, tuition, books. How am I going to survive day to day? I need a stipend so I can have food and stuff, right? And I remember times my mom would tell me, because she actually works at the university in Grenada, and she would tell me, because I would feel frustrated. I was like, Mom, I got accepted into this school and they're giving me this. It's just tuition. It's just a stipend that's missing. And she would tell me, Curlin, listen to me. I see it every day. I see students with scholarships like yours, and they're forced to live in their car, or sometimes we have to bring them lunch. I know what I'm telling you. It's not enough. You also need something where you would have a little pocket money at the end of the day. And I was like, Mom, come on. We can do this. And she would tell me very patiently, well, as patient as a West Indian parent can be. So that means like she would say it about once or twice. Curlin, I know what I'm telling you. It's like this and like this. I didn't understand until I finally came to Morocco, but we'll get there eventually.
Right. So I'll pause you real quick. So Peter was your mentor. Was that from the beginning of your scholarship process? So early secondary school years?
No, when did that early begin? Early school years. No, I think I got to know him. College years, definitely. Late secondary school years, yes. Early, no. It was only after started having the interest in technical drawing, because before they didn't know where to orient me. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Right. It's only after I got it in my head, had an inkling for architecture, that they were able to orient me towards him.
Okay, so that was going to be my question. This was a match that was made based on your interests.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, all right, carry on.
Okay, yeah. So once again, that's how they operate at the J.J. Robinson Foundation. It's not trust, my bad, the J.J. Robinson Trust. It's not just about paying your school fees and everything. No, no, no. They also try to orient you so you can become a better person in the future. And for example, myself, whenever I come back, sometimes they would have me come and give presentations to the students that are there so that I could also become their mentors. It's really a circle of continually giving. And right. We've had lots who've been there, and it's really effective, and that's how they were able to match me up.
How does one become involved with the foundation? How did you find it and sign up?
That was my dad. I think my dad was the one who brought us there. I think he knew one of the trustees, and he presented them with my report card. So at that time it was myself and my younger sister. And they were like, okay, your kids have good grades. We understand your financial difficulties and we will totally help you out. And that means giving you bus fares, paying the school fees, any examination fees you have to pay, we will cover that. which was really wonderful, honestly. I don't know how far we would have come if they have not been there to help us, especially after Ivan. I don't know if we would have even been able to come to continue. They were tremendously helpful. So that's how it worked out for me. It was my dad who knew someone, and he did the process for us. At the end, when we became more involved, now we were the ones, we could even orient people there. We can volunteer our time, anything that they need.
Okay. It's very interesting. Okay. Yeah. I've heard of it before, but it's definitely a good one to put on people's radar.
Definitely. Guys, if you need any, if you want to be accepted into this new family of people who are there to help each other and to achieve each together and to grow together, check them out. They have a Facebook page as well, the JJ Robinson Trust. You can go there and there will be someone there to respond to you. All right. So moving on with the scholarship. Well, I got the scholarship. I was told I had to go to Morocco. I would not lie. I did not know what a Morocco was before I came here. So the first thing I had to do was look up, where is Morocco? So I went and I looked it up and I was like, oh my God, it's a Muslim country. What? They speak French. What? I was like, no way. Now, I'm Adventist, right? Mm-hmm. And to many people, this was a radical move. They were like, Carlin, how can you go? How can you leave the Caribbean to go now and speak to go now and live in a Muslim country? Their values are so completely different as to what we have. How can this happen? I had lots of people who tried to discourage me. They were like, you shouldn't do this. Why don't you try looking for another scholarship? Or why don't you just get a student loan? You know, you just have to pay the interest. And in my head, I'm thinking, I'm looking for a scholarship with a stipend and everything, and you're telling me about paying interest. Are you gonna pay the interest while I'm not there? So anyway, being as stubborn as I am and having my family's full support, I was accepted and I left the island to head to Morocco. Now, I'll spare you the emotional tidbits, what it was like having to leave my family, my friends, to go someplace that I didn't know of. Yeah. And I got here.
Okay. So you got there. How did you even acclimate? So did you speak French before that?
Oh, no. I did Spanish. Because, you know, I'm so smart. I did Spanish as a foreign language for CXC. French, the only thing I knew how to say in French when I got here was, good morning. That was it. That's the only thing I know, good morning. And it was very intimidating because there were other children on scholarships as well from Grenada who had studied French. And who they, of course, they weren't fluent, but they could go to the shop and ask for things. Whereas I'm there pointing to everything that I wanted. However, the scholarship also provides for that. So when you just get here, you have a year, not even a year. It's more like 6 months, sometimes 9 months. I think for us, it was between, let's say it was 7 months. 7 months during which you do nothing but learn the French language. It has different effects on people. And I'll explain this. If you've ever had to be in a situation where you have to learn a language, you would understand that a language, it's a living thing. It's not just learning verbs, how to conjugate them, and making perfect sentences. No, not at all. And this is what we were focused on during the 6 months. So you would have a large vocabulary of verbs. You would be writing perfectly. However, you can't express yourself. You may be able to understand, maybe, but expressing yourself is always the hardest thing to do. And this is where people usually had issues. You can read, you can write, but when people speak, you don't understand. And if you do understand, you can't express yourself. So once again, the training my parents gave me for being a super achiever, from since my young, I was a younglin, it came into effect. So I was like, we're only doing 3 days a week, right? I have these entire months just to learn French. So seeing as I'm very good at being a teacher's pet, I'll go be a teacher's pet to another teacher and ask if I can also join their classes. So like that, my classes increased from 3 classes a week to 6 classes a week. Because usually what happens is, because here in Morocco, they accept such a large amount of students from all over the world, and it's not everyone who speaks French. So anyone who comes from a country, be it Bolivia, we have Panamanians, St. Lucians, or Asian countries, African countries, even some Europeans. You come here, you have to first learn the language. And so I was saying, okay, I'm just going to join another class to get additional lessons. Or even if they're doing the same thing we're doing, it's going to help me to further concrete those ideas. So that was the first step. Now, that helped with my understanding of the grammar and the sentence constructions and stuff. But I still have the problem of speaking. And I'm a super talkative person. So that really bugged me. I was like, I want to speak, but I can't. What do I do? So I used the skills I learned in being in so many students' associations and stuff. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go out every day to the campus gardens. And the first unlucky person I find, I'm just going to start talking to them. Quite simply. Like, literally. I have a time of the day when I don't have any revisions. I don't have any classes. I have nothing to do. I'm going to go sit in the garden and just talk to a random person in French. Now, in the beginning, it's catastrophic because, once again, you know how to say, you know how to do your conjugations, you know how to write your sentences, but you're not so good at expressing yourself. So your subjects and verbs are all coming out mixed up. Your sentences is backwards. You're using the wrong verbs. You're mispronouncing things. But people are very patient. They understand what's going on. And in the space of, I think, 3 months, there was one guy in particular. He really liked my devotion and he was like, okay, I'm going to help you out. I get what you're doing and I appreciate it because I know it's hard, especially for people who speak English, so we call them Anglophones. Especially for Anglophones, Anglo-Saxons, I know it's very hard. So I like your devotion, I'll help you out. Great. So he was doing, I think, his master's. No, there was no backstory to that. There's nothing happening in the back. He was just literally a good person. And he would be there. He would encourage me. He would correct me. He would practice with me my pronunciation. That went great. It really helped. Then I thought, okay, maybe I should, if it's working so well with him, I should still have random persons that I'm speaking to. And I still did that. Because as time goes along, you understand the grammatical structures, you understand them better. So I didn't need to devote as much time to studies because I'm starting to understand now.
Right.
So my problem remained expressing myself. I still practice with speaking with people and that's really what helped. To improve my vocabulary. Now, we had the verbs that we did at school, but if you've ever had to learn a foreign language, you'd understand that people never speak the language the way it's supposed to be written. There's always nuances, or they're going to use idiomatic expressions that you've never heard before. And you're like, what? This is not how they taught it to me in school. What are you saying?
Right. And then every country or location has their own little dialect and, you know, their own terms that they use that you never see in the books.
Exactly. So now when I felt that I had graduated from speaking to international students and I wanted to go speak to actual Moroccans and actual French-speaking people, that's when I learned, hey, what I'm learning and what's happening on the street is not the same thing. I need to learn what they're speaking. So I started off by reading children's book. Children's book, it was really good with repetition. So it would go like, so this was like in the beginning days. I'll get a book for a kid, you know, two-year-old. And it's very good with repetition. It will be like, this is John. John has a ball. The ball is blue. He likes to play with the ball. Like that, you see the word ball, 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 over and over and over again. And you're seeing the image with it. As big as I was, shamelessly, I'm on the tram. I'm on the metro. I don't care. I'm reading my children's book and I'm practicing. Then eventually, within the same 6 months, I was able to move from reading children's books to reading books for, you know, from toddlers, young children, to adolescents, to adults. So actual novels. So I had the reading parts covered. I won't lie, the listening parts took a bit longer. Even when I got to university, I was still working on that. Because people have different accents, they speak with different speed, they use different expressions. And this one, even today, I'm much better than I was then. But like I said in the beginning, a language, it's a living, breathing thing. It's always mutating, it's always changing. And then there are variations from different regions.
Right.
So to make a long story short, with the language learning part, I think I went from being one of the students who knew the least, because we had some students there who were French teachers and everything. And at the end of that year, I had the highest grade for everyone from not just from Grenada, but from the entire Caribbean region and among English-speaking persons. So went from being completely intimidated by my classmates when the teacher is saying, come up to the board to conjugate the verb. And I have never seen this verb before. I don't know how to conjugate it. To being one of the students, at the end of the 6 months, they had like a little ceremony. And they asked me to do a little, to take part in a play because they liked how dramatic I was and how expressive I was. And the way I would pronounce stuff correctly, my vocabulary, you know, generally the way I had advanced from the first month to the sixth or seventh month. Just goes to show you that really it's determination and hard work.
Right, which clearly you have a lot of determination. So no surprise that you got that far that quickly. So fast forward a little bit. What were your studio classes at the university like? So first of all, were they taught in English or in French? And then what was it like transitioning from, you know, the more technical aspects at TAMCC to now learning architecture?
All right. So the first 5 years of my school, no, the entire time it was in French. Everything was in French. The first year, we did a lot of sciences, so it was a bit similar to what we were doing in architecture, you know, we're in TAMCC with bending forces and plumbing and those stuff. It was like a continuation of that, and that actually helped, especially with the physics parts, because I did not do physics for neither CXC nor CAPE, and now we were doing A-level physics. So I was like, what? What this? And it was the same thing like it was with the language. I was like, okay, I don't understand what's going on. And the students are like, me, I know. I want to answer this question. I was like, oh, goddamn. And yeah, so they were in French, but we always started off by having the architecture major. The first year was very easy because they started off on the understanding that the students there, they know nothing about architecture. So they really started with the basics. So in that first semester, architecture was the least of my problems because, you know, it was just the basics. So it wasn't even that different from TAMCC because we were still doing boxes with some circles on the side. And I started to become like disappointed. I was like, why did I come here? Why are they doing this? This is the same boring things I was doing before that I hated. But everything else was a problem. Everything else was still an issue because I was doing, you know, of course, there are the theoretical classes, lots of French. I was still learning to understand. But the architecture part got better from the second semester because now that all the students knew the basics, they actually started to introduce concepts to us and it was really beautiful. So we started to study different design theories and different modular designs and all this stuff. And that's when it really started to get interesting, when I started to become pretty excited about it. The only time I was able to study architecture in English, that was in my second year of master's. So that would have been fifth semester. I chose a teacher who only taught in English. Now he was doing some pretty interesting concepts, which I wanted to do. It was about resilience. But resilience not only to climate and everything, but complete resilience. That means using local architectural vernacular trying to stray away from international types of architecture, and by this universal architecture, you're saying like we shouldn't have a building that we should uproot from one country and just put it into another. Mm-hmm. People are supposed to be able to identify with it, to find something that is in it off their culture, something that they can say, hey, I know this. This building is welcoming me. So I really like those concepts. So if that answers your question, all the classes were in French, except for that one. Of course, and this might be surprising to many people, even though we were at university here, you still had to do a foreign language. Huh. Now, okay. I already had my hands filled because with all my courses, I was like, oh my God, we have all these science courses. So we have acoustics, we have thermics, we have thermodynamics, we have mechanical structure. We have all these things to do, all right? So I have all my science courses. I have all my theoretical courses, history of architecture, history of cities, heritage, all these things. Of course, I chose English as my foreign language. Like, I'm doing English, okay, me first. It was like my breath of fresh air. I was like, oh, finally, a class in which I can relax. Finally, because it was really difficult, I'm telling you, the first semester, I'm not going to lie to anyone. I may make it seem easy, but it is really hard. The first semester, let me tell you, I learned what it meant to pay attention. I had never paid attention so much in my life. When the teacher is speaking to you in this foreign language, for which you only know conversational grammar, they're giving you all these technical terms. For the first semester, I could look neither left nor right. The entire session, I have to look at the teacher. So this means, of course, I cannot be taking notes, because if I'm taking notes, I'm not understanding what he's saying. So it was very tiresome, because I would attend the lectures, I would record the lectures, then I would go home, listen to the recordings, and make notes. So my attending is just to understand the way he explains stuff and everything. Then when I get home, I make notes. So when I'm doing my revisions, I have something to revise from. I had no social life in first semester. Forget that. And when I say no social life, I'm talking about even watching movies. I didn't have time for that. I don't have time. Because let's imagine you have 6 lectures per day. That's 6 hours of record, 12 hours of recordings you have to go home to listen to at night. On top of all of your assignments, projects, and homework. When do you have time to look at a movie? I lost so much weight.
So you weren't eating either.
When do you have time to cook? Tell me when. When do you cook? My food were milk, cereal. I had all the different types of cereal you can imagine. Yogurt and fruits. That was it. It kept me going, but I was super thin. And I remember because I didn't go home at the end of French year, because my parents thought, of course, not me. My parents thought, you're learning the language. I think it's best you stay so you can, you know, advance a little bit during the summer. Because if you come home, it's going to be English and you have to go to university. Ugh. Of course, they were right. They were right. I saw that later on. They were absolutely right. But I did go home at the end of my first year. And my mom, I remember she wanted to cry when she saw me. She literally wanted to cry. She was like, oh my God, don't worry, we're going to fatten you up. And she said these exact words, we're going to fatten you up before we send you back. Don't worry. And they sent me back with only food, as if they thought the problem was me not being able to find food and not me not having time to cook food. But it was just for the first semester. Eventually, it became easier. Easy, not yet. It only became relatively easy after the third year. But the first 2 years were the hardest, with the first semester, of course, being the hardest.
So let me jump in here. You talked a little bit about, you know, the different years, and then you talked about your master's year. What was the format of this architecture program? How many years was it? What type of degree did you get at the end?
Okay, so the one in Morocco, it follows the French system. So we have, it's a professional course, and it's the entire duration is 6 years. The first 3 years are dedicated towards you doing your bachelor's, the last 3 years are for your master's. Now, of course, the first 2 years, you're doing general courses. You're not yet specialized. The third year, you're giving an idea of the different specialties you can take. So you start off by doing, hang on, let me try to translate these words. Landscaping, urban design, urban management, or basic architecture, resilient architecture. You're doing all of these things in third year, because in the fourth year, when you start specializing. So that's your first year of master's. That's when you start specializing based on the things that you had seen in third year. Also, of course, you have different seminars that you can take part of to have, you know, minors in different things. So, for example, I did resilient architecture with a minor in landscaping and heritage restoration. Now, for my PhD, I'm considering doing, because I'm really passionate about the resilience and ecological architecture and stuff. So I want to continue with that. But I think this time I want to minor in managing urban risks.
Okay. And describe for those listening what urban risks means.
So it means that you have to study the individual components of a city. So we're going to have, of course, you're going to study the form of the city, which we call the morphology. You're going to also look at the type of functions that the city hosts, the typology of them. And you're going to study how they function both collectively and individually. Now, when you're doing urban planning and risk management, it means that you're going to have to study and analyze risks that occur right now, find solutions for them, and find ways to mitigate risks that are going to happen over a span of 10, 20, or 50 years. Here in Morocco, we usually do it for 20 years. So what changes will the city see? Was I saying ville this entire time?
No, you were saying town and city.
Okay, good. I'm good. It happens. I promise you it happens.
So, I can imagine.
You have to study some of the problems or the issues, the setbacks that are going to come, and you're going to discover, would it be able to find solutions, or are you going to have to mitigate? For example, urban sprawl, that's the increasing growth of urban areas as they go into the periphery, I'm not sure if that's an English word, and take up more of the countryside and the surrounding areas. Are we going to be able to stop that? Can we mitigate that? Can we find solution ways to live with it? What can we do to encourage, for example, social mixing? Or because usually in a city, we have a zone for the well-off members of society, a zone for the working class, and zones, well, it's usually zones like little clusters, and zones for, you know, the least fortunate members of society. How can we encourage each of these aspects to integrate with each other? How can we do that? What about transportation? And this is usually the biggest risks that you usually have to manage and plan for are housing, transport, and drainage and sewage. These are the number one ones that you usually always have to plan for. So I'm considering doing a PhD on that. Not yet sure. Yeah, so that's how it's going to be now. For my master's, I'm not sure if I had finished explaining that, but I did, ecology, resilience, social inclusion. So okay. I had already started on, because I knew this is what I wanted to do. Well, I always knew this is what I wanted to do. I've known it since they first introduced me to the topic of real architectural ecology. What it really means to be sustainable. Yes, sustainability. Yes, that's the word. Sustainability. So I always knew that I wanted to go into that field. So I did it for my master's, and I want to continue in that direction for my PhD. However, I don't want it to just be limited to architecture, because that's a smaller domain. I want to see it on the urban scale. So I'm going to be majoring in urbanism with a minor in architecture. Whereas last time I did a major in architecture, minored in landscaping, urbanism, and those other stuff.
Right. And so here we're thinking of, you know, architecture as more of the building scale and urbanism as more of the city scale. Would that be correct?
That's exactly what it is.
Okay. Great. All right. So you finished your degree. When did you graduate? How long ago?
2019. I graduated in 2019. You know, whenever people ask that, I like to precise. Guys, it makes you, it really depends on you because it's not easy. I remember when I was doing exams and I would always doubt myself because not only am I not sure that I understood what the teacher was explaining, but when you're used to being an overachiever, then you're getting just passing grades in the first few years. It really, really dampens your will to go on. It really gets you down.
Yep.
But I can say, thankfully, by the time I had gotten to my master's course, I had graduated with first class honors. It's not an easy thing. I went through lots of things to get there. Of course, the number one being weight loss. That's like my favorite stress release. Just lose weight, right? And I had finished that. And it's actually the agency which brings us here because there's a cooperation between the Moroccan government and the Grenadian government, and they're the ones encouraging me to continue on with my PhD. I'm still decided. I'm going to apply, of course, but we'll see what's going to happen.
Right. So the current job that you have as a professor, how did you get that job after graduating?
You would never believe that it just fell into my, it just fell on me. I had no inkling of becoming a professor. I just wanted to do architecture. I just wanted to create my beautiful buildings, go to sites, manage my sites, and that will be fine. Mm-hmm. But it literally just fell upon me. A friend was like, hey, we have a private school and we're looking for lecturers who are going to be there to orient students who want to go to do architecture. So you're going to be doing things like history of architecture theory, business English, professional English, and those stuff. I was like, I already have my handfuls. I don't think I have time for this. But because I like taking on a risk, in case you haven't noticed, I came to Morocco. I guess the council or anything, I was like, you know, this looks like a challenge. I'm going to try it. And I did. And I've been doing that for, I think next month is going to make it exactly 1 year.
Wow, okay. And do you intend to continue with that while you're doing your PhD or no?
Definitely. Because it pays and I like money. So I'm definitely considering doing it because the PhD is at least over here. It can be either 1 to 3 years. It really depends on you. Some students do it in 4, some students do it in 5. Mm-hmm. But the first year is basically teaching you how to do the research that you need to do. Right. And instilling in you the concepts that you're going to use when developing your research. We did them briefly in some courses for the master's, but now it's going to be, of course, way deeper. So the first year is dedicated to that. Because most people who do their PhD are working class people, here we don't have much more than 3, sometimes 4 hours of classes a day. So like that, you can work around it. So I'm hoping, well, I'm considering, because I'm not, like I said, I'm not yet sure. I'm considering continuing on with this job if I do the PhD.
Got it. Okay. Well, good luck to you on whichever decision you make.
Thank you.
So I want to switch gears a little bit here. Because I do know that your work was recently selected to be brought to life on an international scale at Expo 2020, which was set to be hosted this year in the United Arab Emirates.
Yes.
So give us a little bit of background on what that competition was and how you managed to get involved.
Well, I think like everything else in my life, this one also fell on me. I did not know about the competition. My sister, the sister I've mentioned before, she was doing her bachelor's at the time. I was in my master's cycle. Also, both of us on scholarships. And she saw the poster. She was like, hey, look at this. It's a poster for a competition. You should do it. I was like, but I'm so busy. I have my thesis to write and I have my part-time job. I'm not sure. the number one doubter of myself is myself sometimes. So I was like, but the price, the cash price looks good. So I'm going to try it. And that's how it went off. So I looked at the conditions. I saw that it's something that we have to use to represent Grenada. There were a few themes that you have to follow. And we were really trying to get away from the usual narrative. Try to create something a little bit more different, more inviting, so we can get a true meaning of what it means to be Grenadian. And that's how I came up with my design, following the nutmeg idea, because this is the first time that the Caribbean region, we've actually had an entire stall. Usually we're just giving an area, but this time we have our own building just for us. So I decided, you know what, it's not just going to be the building, but my building is also going to be motion sensitive and covered with LEDs, with LED monitors all over like that. You're going to, and of course, motion sensitive audio systems. So depending on where you are, you can listen and look at the forest. You can also look at investment areas. It really has everything that you need to get the complete Grenadian experience. I also decided to include virtual reality because one of the themes were, I think, technology. This was 2 years ago, so pardon me if my memory isn't sharp on. I think one of them was either technology or innovation. So I decided also to include some virtual reality into that. Of course, we have the business area, but one thing that I did not want to miss out was having a performance stage. Because with any project, of course, you have to do research. And I noticed that whenever there's a World Expo, the pavilions that are the most visited are those with a performance stage. Because yes, people like the things that are on display. Yes, they like that. However, when you're giving a performance, this is where they can see, they can hear, they can take part in what it means to be Grenadian, or whichever country that you represented. So I have a performance stage, and I had scheduled different performances from different groups to really get people going, to give them a genuine feeling of what it means to have Grenadian spirit.
Right. And so was this competition open to pretty much everyone across the world to represent their own country, or were there specific countries that were being requested?
No, it was for every country who is taking part in the World 2020 Expo. They were encouraging, of course, you didn't have to do it because it really depends on the country. And what they were doing is encouraging students to get involved from a young age. So getting you involved, not just in theoretical designs, but what it means to create, because there were lots of feedback, lots of changes that had to be made, specifications that had to be met, so that you know what it's like to do a real project under deadlines and constraints. Is that
right. So what was the process like for you? Were you working by yourself or with a team? And then how long did you have to develop this whole concept and design to then present to the judges?
Well, sadly for me, I was by myself because it's only open to nationals, to people from that country. So at my university, there was only one other Grenadian and he wasn't interested. So I was doing it by myself. Of course, because you can't do everything by yourself. So I would have people assist me with the renders. That's to say, I've already done the designs and I need their computer for 8 hours or for however long it's going to take to make my designs come into images or videos. So I'll have them assist me with that part. But the concept was 100% me.
Wow. Okay. And we'll try to link some, you know, images or something of your project at the end of this so people can see what it is that we're talking about. All right. So then when did you find out that you were selected, and what happened from then? So I guess first of all, is this expo still happening? I know it's not happening in 2020 anymore due to, you know, COVID and all of that. But is it still expected to happen in the future?
Yes, it is. It's still crowded to take part. It's just been postponed till next October. And we're going to see if it's going to happen, actually. There was even a process with Grenadia where they had encouraged people to apply to go there and be pavilion attendants and stuff. And seeing as I had done the designs and stuff, of course, mm-hmm. I had tendered my application for that. Everything had gone well, in fact. Everything was set. I was supposed to be in the sunny Emirates, but then Corona came and, you know, canceled everything. So hopefully next season. I found out, so the competition took place. The deadline was, I think, in July. And I think I found out around the next year, April or something like that. Oh. So I had absolutely forgotten. I was like, what? Which competition is this? Oh my God, I won. What did I win? What is this? Oh, that competition. Yay. So I had forgotten. And it was around that time I was getting ready to present my thesis. So I was like, wow, this is like a double celebration. I won. So of course I called my parents. I was like, Mom and Dad, I won. Yay. And everyone was super happy. I messaged my mentor and everyone who had encouraged me and everything. So yeah, that's how it went.
So was the expectation, or is the expectation, for you to now become involved with the construction of this pavilion in real time?
Yes, that is what I'm expecting to do. Not involved in the construction, but mostly it's going to be mostly overseeing. And right. then also yeah. I would like to be a pavilion attendant, because like I said, I'm super talkative and I know the concept. So I really just want to be out there to represent Grenada. Now, this is you haven't asked this question, but this is something that I really want to say. My goals for the future, as much as I love architecture and I love creating, I actually want to lecture. And I'll explain why. Everyone, once you've gone through school and you have the concepts, everyone can design. Your designs may be different, but you have the general ideas of the things that you should and shouldn't do. However, and this was very saddening to me, while I was doing my research for my master's, I realized that there aren't many legislations or guidelines in place, not just for Grenada, but for the Caribbean region, mm-hmm. as to how we should build to be completely compatible to nature. So everyone, apart, of course, from there are certain things that we have to do for hurricanes. And sad thing to know, they were only put in, like, they really became regulatory in 2015 for the Caribbean area. And I was really shocked because we get hurricanes every year. So I was really shocked. So at that point, I decided, you know what? I need to go into research to be on whichever committee there will be in the future, which will establish guidelines as to how we should do things in the Caribbean. Not just because it's the way we're used to doing it, but doing them sustainably. And I was pleasantly pleased when I saw that Grenada and other Caribbean islands, we've set out on a 2030 vision. And one of these visions is becoming environmentally sustainable, which is exactly the things that I've been studying I have been doing for the last few years. So I really want to go into research, at least for a few years, until the legislations will be in place and everything. Of course, I can continue doing, you know, a few designs on the side, but I'm really more focused on this right now.
That's definitely something that, you know, Grenada and the whole Caribbean needs to really push us further, you know, in terms of how we think about design, how we think about the things that we create that then affect the environment. Because nothing is, you know, in a silo. It's all interwoven, it all works together, and anything that you do, what is it, every action has an equal and opposite reaction, right? So even the good things that you think you're creating, it has some kind of negative effect on the environment or the place that you put it.
Definitely.
Right. That's good to hear. Okay, so if you could go back to your 14, 15 year old self now and give her a little bit of advice of how to chart, you know, what's coming in the future, what would you say to her?
I would tell her to continue on the path that she is on. Because the fact that you're a scholarship student, it really, sometimes you think that there are things that you will never be able to do. I never thought I would be able to get it to go this far at university. I thought that the only thing that was open for me is open campus in with UWE on the Carenage. I really thought that was it. I never thought I would be able to have this opportunity to leave, discover a completely new culture, new language, and do many of the things that I've done. So I would tell 14-year-old me to keep believing in herself, even as difficult as it can be, because 14-year-old me just went through Ivan. She lost her home, and it was a very stressful time. I think this is the lowest she had been. She was actually getting counseling at that time. So I would tell her to continue on the path she is on. Don't doubt herself. Just continue being the good student that she is, that everything would work out. Everything would work out. And this is not just for 14-year-old me. This is for every Grenadian student who is coming from a home without financial needs. Some even have it worse, because I was blessed. I had both my mom and my dad together. But most people, some people we just have just a single parent household, and it's double the stress. So you have additional responsibilities to your academic responsibilities. You have things you have to do at home. Sometimes you have to get a part-time job or a summer job. I knew I was doing a summer job, right? And you think that your life is going to be in a certain way. You think that everything that is good, everything that is excellent is not for you, because you simply can't afford it, and there is no way you would be able to do it. Guys, listen to me. Go to the ministry, go to the scholarship desk, and find out the scholarships that are there. You may have to leave, you may have to learn a new language, but, and I'm telling you this from experience, there is nothing that hard work, determination, and faith in God cannot do. If you really want something, you're going to put every iota of every last drop of energy that you have into it until you get it. Even if it means only seeing your friends at the end of semesters, because that's what it was for me. I was studying in a city away from all the other Caribbean students. By the way, I was the only one. So I thought, this is my bad luck. How is it that I'm the only Caribbean student going all the way 3 hours away by train from the near Caribbean prison? But it all worked out. I was completely focused. It pushed me to learn the language better, because I was living with people who only spoke French. There was no reprise when I got home, thinking that, okay, when I get home, I'll speak English with my Caribbean friends. No! French at school, French in the streets, French at home. It was do or die. Do or die. So, guys, you can do it. Because sometimes we hear people sharing their experience, and yes, it was hard for anyone. Anyone who's gone to university has had it hard. But at least they had the means. When you're coming from a household where all you have is your brain and your determination, but you don't have the means and you think that you're never going to get them, you really think that there are things, other things that are blocked off from you. So this is for all of you young students listening. Nothing is impossible, like for real. Take it from me. It's not easy. And I cannot underline this enough. It is not easy. There will be many things you will have to sacrifice. Many things. If you like partying, well, forget this. You're going to have to party once a year. You like drinking, you might have to put this apart. You like going to the movies. Darling, no. You have to study. It is going to be really annoying. Sometimes I felt like I was losing my mind. So I'll just go sit in the on the veranda for a few hours. Then there's also the shock of being in a different country. So we're used to at home, if we're feeling stressed, go sit next to the river or at the beach. When I was feeling stressed and I go to my rooftop, all I see are other rooftops for as far as the eye can see. Other rooftops. And it was not at all soothing. But you make do, and you keep fighting on until the day you can actually, you know, do what you want to do.
Right. Nothing worth having comes easily.
Definitely. So,
and I think an important thing is when you know what you want to do, and you set out with that determination. And this may not be, you know, the same for everyone. Not everyone knows exactly what it is that they want to do or what they want to accomplish. But the fact is, you just have to kind of keep pushing through, keep trying new things to then find your path.
Because even for me, even though I always knew I wanted to do architecture, when I came to Morocco, initially they had not given me architecture. They gave me civil engineering. Oh. And they told me, you can do the first year, and then at the end of the first year, you will transfer to the architecture school. I refused. I was like, no, I don't want this. I don't want this. And because of my insistence and God's grace and fighting, it took me 6 weeks. So I started school 2 weeks before midterms. So it took me 6 weeks to finally get them to change their minds. And this 6 weeks that I'm doing negotiations, I'm trying to get them to change their minds because I don't want to do civil engineering. Other people are at school and they're learning and they're getting the materials they need. And their first set of, it wasn't midterms. We do like two sets of exams and the final exam. So it was the first exams that were coming up in 2 weeks. And I was having none of this. Not only that, when I finally got it, I was in a school that was 3 hours away. So I had to move all my stuff, find a new apartment because there were no dormitories there. So I had to find an apartment. And all of this while preparing for exams.
Wow.
It's like Arlene said, nothing that you truly want ever comes easy. You have to fight for it and make it happen. I passed my exams though. were my marks great? Far from it. Not even going to lie. Far from it. But I passed, and that's the most important thing. I passed.
Yeah.
The others were better, but you know, those were very disappointing grades I got.
Yeah. And that can be a real shock, you know, coming from being an A student to, you know, exactly, barely passing. I feel your pain there.
Exactly. And you're wondering, when did I become stupid? Or you doubt yourself and you said, you know what, maybe university is too much for me.
Mm.
You know, maybe they were right. Maybe this is too much for me. Maybe I should give up. And you would be sad to know that a lot of the time, these thoughts come from yourself, because my parents never said that. My family members never said that. But there were times that I felt like, this is too much for me. Maybe I should just give up. Maybe university just isn't for me. Because how could I go from getting all these stellar grades and accolades to barely passing this semester? I was, that first semester, those first set of exams, I was just hoping to pass. I just wanted to pass. And that had never been me. So it can really get you down. Really, mm-hmm. It can. But it gets easier. It gets easier with time.
I'm glad that you stuck it through.
Do or die. Do or die.
So if there are students or, you know, young people listening here who would like to learn more about what you do or just want to, you know, get some advice, get involved with your work, how can they reach you?
Okay, so you can reach out to me via my Facebook account. So it's Kerlyn Frank, K-E-R-L-Y-N, Frank, F-R-A-N-K. You can reach out to me there. I am the super nicest person ever. So you can ask me all the questions you need to ask, because I know what it feels like not knowing what you wanted and having people who are experienced, who are there to guide me. So of course, any chance I get to return all the kindness that were given to me to get me where I am today, definitely. So reach out to me, guys. I'm a normal person. I understand the struggles. Reach out to me and I'll be happy to help.
Great. Well, Kerlyn, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. It's been a really good conversation, and I'm glad that we were able to kind of talk through some of this and, you know, humanize the whole experience of going through university and pursuing a career in this way.
It has been my honor, because I believe that the more we share our experiences is the more we teach people that it is normal to go through certain struggles.
Amen.
So guys, just reach out to us, and yeah, I'm here to help.
And to the listeners, thank you for joining us on today's Pathway.